You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Now it's time to introduce our next amazing talk, and I think it's a huge privilege that we're joined here today by Victoria McLeod, the UK's first trans High Court judge. And earlier this week, you may have read in the news that she's launched a case against the UK challenging the Supreme Court's ruling on biological sex. So I'm sure we're going to hear loads more about that, and also get your questions ready. There will be a Q&A at the end. And the other thing to say is that we have got our welfare team over here in the blue. So if there's anything at all during or after this event that you want to chat to them about, they're here for you. So please make use of them if you would like to. And chairing this event, we've got the wonderful, I'm going to say Greenbelt legend, Rachel Mann, who is a priest, theologian, and award-winning poet. So I'm going to hand over to Rachel.
Thank you so much. It's absolutely wonderful to be back. And now is the time, friends, for that trans takeover of the festival. Isn't it great that, you know, we haven't got to segregation at the festival? I mean, please, Lord, may that never, ever happen. But given the way things are going at the moment, we really are in terrifying times for trans people. And we're going to really get into the subject of fear, of hope, of promise, not only for trans people, but for all people, for cis people as well, because the stuff we're going to talk about this afternoon genuinely impacts us all, even though it is very specifically impacting trans people like Vicky and me. So, Vicky, I mean, you really are an absolute legend. I've had the privilege of spending a lot of time with her over the past 24 hours. This woman is a genuine force of nature. This is not the first time that she's taken the UK to the law courts. She may actually say something more about that in a little while. This woman genuinely will get to the point where the likes of Keir Starmer are just genuinely going to have to sit down on a table across from her and get with the program. Yes. So, Vicky, where I wanted to start is with a personal story, actually. So we had this ruling in April, terrifying for trans people. And there's been all sorts of fallout from that and interpretations, I would say misinterpretations of that ruling. We've had interim guidance from the so-called Equalities and Human Rights Commission. But it can be difficult for us to locate that at a human level.
Yeah.
I was in hospital at one of my most vulnerable points on the day that announcement was made. And I was just absolutely sure that the judgment would not go the way that it's gone. I was lying in a bed, having had major surgery, after having 9 days on intensive care. I'd been moved to the women's ward. The announcement was made. And I was absolutely convinced for 2 days that someone was going to come and move me to the men's ward. I went into a complete and utter psychological and spiritual meltdown. Vicky, this is real shit.
Yes, it is. Yes.
How on earth have we ended up in a place where those of us who just want to live our lives, want to piss when we need to piss, are terrified?
Yeah. I mean, I think going back to the days when we were campaigning in the 90s to get the Gender Recognition Act, I think we thought we'd done it once we got that, once we achieved legal recognition under that act. And I think we stopped trying to educate. Maybe we took it for granted. So as a result, whereas in the time the act was passed, actually people knew quite a lot about what being trans was, and there was no trouble getting the bill passed. But because we just took it for granted and didn't keep educating people, I think there's a lot of people who just don't know enough about it. And when people meet us, they do change their minds quite often. But that's been exploited, I think, by people who have a rather wider agenda, really. And it's about natalism. It's about a sort of notion of biological hierarchy. It is about men's and women's roles in life and what a woman should be and how a woman should look. And that's why, of course, a lot of lesbians are getting a lot of abuse now, because they, many of them, choose not to be appearing in a stereotypical Western feminine manner. And of course, they're being abused for being trans. They're getting it worse than we are in the loos, often asked to leave. So fundamentally, it's actually a judgment against lesbians. And the fact lesbians were all redefined in the judgment, so that a couple, one woman married to another woman where one of the women is trans, they're now a straight couple. Their permission was not asked. And the cis woman in that relationship, their permission wasn't asked. If they have a kid, if you turn it on its head, if you have a trans man marries a woman, they have kids, that's now a lesbian relationship. So the child now has same-sex parents and is going to have to adjust to that. Children's rights weren't considered in the judgment, for example. But I think we've got there because of a lack of ordinary, everyday experience of people knowing trans people, because trans people like to just disappear and get on with our lives. We don't like to put our heads over the parapet because there are people that make threats or harm us. And as a result, we've been perhaps too good at hiding. And now we're being forced to come out of hiding.
But is it, and I'm being a bit devil's advocate-y here, that's the way things might be presented. And let's be clear here, I'm queer enough to want things to be desperately queer. In other words, if a trans relationship where marriage to a cis woman gets redefined as, lesbian at one level, at a theological or spiritual philosophical level, let's queer it up, but...
Yes. Yeah, make the most of it.
But nonetheless, to play devil's advocate, it's not quite as simple as that. I mean, you've gone so far, Vicky, as to say that we've ended up in a situation where effectively trans people who've got gender recognition certificates, who have transitioned in all ways in which are permitted by law, have ended up as
two sexes. Whoopee!
And
yes.
Can you just... I mean, seriously. I mean, I've got a decent...
I am Mr. and Mrs.
I've got a decent-ish brain, but I can't get my head around that. So, because can you just unpack that for us? What on earth does that mean, two sexes at once?
Yeah, I mean, the Supreme Court decision said that... They didn't invent a definition. They said that the Equality Act, which governs the whole of equality law, when it uses the word sex, it means what they said was biological sex, which is not a legally recognised or defined term. But they really mean what it says on your first birth certificate, effectively. But only for that act, only for that statute. It's not for the whole of law, which means that for everything else, I am legally a woman. But for equality law, I am legally a man. Which means I don't have a right to equal pay with men anymore. Because to bring an equal pay claim, you have to be of the opposite sex. So if I were to try and bring the McLeod pension case again, I wouldn't be able to plead it as an equal pay claim because I would be comparing myself with other men, and you can't do that. So trans women lost the right to equal pay with men overnight.
I mean, this is... Yeah. I'm trying to find the right word that I can say that isn't, just completely out there, but this is...
Pretty
beyond bearable. Yes, I mean, this is beyond bearable.
Yes.
So what's the way through? I mean, to put it another way, the Supreme Court arguably have come in for a right bashing about this judgment. Is that entirely fair? I mean, is it the problem?
Is it
the Equality Act is is a hot mess.
I don't know a single lawyer who would say that the Supreme Court judgment is legally correct, let alone intelligible, sadly. So most lawyers don't really quite follow it, but it's actually just legally wrong. It's a very, sadly, I'm talking about people I know. I mean, three of the judges who wrote the judgment I know personally. One of them's known me since before I transitioned. One of them I've worked for decades doing equality and diversity work. So these are not people who are ignorant of trans people, far from it. And actually, I don't think intolerant of trans people. They as I say, they know me personally. And I hope they're not offended when I say they really messed this one up. And they messed it up, I think partly because they didn't hear both sides of the argument, unfortunately. I think probably in good faith, they thought they were, because they had a range of organisations in front of them, ostensibly representing different interests, lesbian and gay people, women, and so on. But in reality, they're a coalition of one movement. So I think they had the illusion of having independent parties and the Equality and Human Rights Commission, which is essentially a gender-critical organisation now.
Let's just say that again.
Yeah.
So the Equality and Human Rights Commission,
I would say it's
which is there, which exists to defend or ensure...
So it should be, yes.
Ensure that all minorities have a fair hearing and are treated equally and fairly under law... is a gender-critical organisation.
And I think that's no surprise, because it is deliberate. I mean, Olukemi Badenoch, or Badenoch, I should say, appointed the head of the HRC herself, essentially, and she's been open about it, because she's gender-critical, because the objective was to fulfil her policy in relation to what has now happened, the biological sex policy. Labour then adopted that policy just before the last election, were very open about the fact that they wanted to exclude us from lavatories and they wanted to segregate us in hospital wards. And that was the zeitgeist. And hence, the head of the HRC has remained the same. And no surprises, the same policy has been adhered to. And lots of lawyers, of course, have left the HRC, I think, being rather unhappy. And those that remain are quite possibly of one opinion. I don't know them personally, but certainly the head is someone
who's been brought in by the Labour government has a track record of being gender critical as well, and I believe that the Women's and Equalities Committee actually opposed her appointment, and Bridget Phillipson has went ahead anyway.
Well, it is Labour policy. I mean, the Supreme Court accidentally gave Labour, I'm not saying they were influenced by the politics, but as it happens, they took a pile off Labour's plate because the Labour policy is trans segregation. It was before the election. They were very open about it. And this has achieved that without them having to legislate. So it's a remarkable win for Labour. I think it's probably going to be a remarkable loss in the end, because people like me are going to keep this in the news right through the next election. It's not going away. And this is why... I do take the view that Keir Starmer needs to talk to people like me, because that's the only way we're going to solve it. Otherwise, we're just going to keep on going and keep on going and keep on going. And they know I can do that because, as you mentioned, I have sued the British state before, and I kept on going and I kept on going. And I won at every stage in the courts, and I brought down the whole public sector pension scheme.
I mean, you are just a badass. Yes, I mean, just to say, if anyone out there does have a public sector pension, you should be thankful to Vicky for ensuring that you have a decent one still.
I'm actually best known as an actuarial remedy. It's really sad.
Well, I mean, we'll pray for you. We'll pray for you.
You'll find there's a thing called the McLeod remedy. It sounds like a kind of sore throat.
Look, I mean, this probably isn't the place really to get into me feeling like a complete and utter fool for having supported the Labour Party at the last election. I mean, it is part of their manifesto to actually make trans people's lives easier.
I was going to vote for them, and I withdrew my vote because they went gender critical about 2 to 3 weeks before the election. After some people, I think, had voted, it was in the postal vote window, which I think is very naughty. It wasn't in their manifesto, but they went public speaking. Because they're scared of the trans issue, because I think of what happened to the Scottish government, brought down the Scottish government. And for sorry, I'm never very good with microphones, sorry. They've never been good with the trans issue. They're scared of it. And they just wanted to, I think, adopt the populist line so as to be no different from all the other parties.
Well, tell us about how you're going to pull off what I hope is possibly the greatest superhero hero move of the decade in terms of taking on the whole of the UK government.
Yes, I know. It's great. It's lovely having like McLeod against the UK.
It's just one. Tell us more about.
Yeah, I mean, I've launched one case and I had to launch that first because you have to do that within 4 months. So I did that just in time. It's really only the first step. Prior to that, of course, those of you who may know this, but many of you may not know that there is actually a genocide red flag alert against the United Kingdom now officially. By the Lemkin Institute. Lemkin was a historian, but he coined the expression genocide. He invented the word genocide. And his framework for having an early warning system is implemented by the Lemkin Institute for genocide prevention. And what they do is they don't go about the place saying you're committing genocide. What they do is they study countries to look for the early warning signs, the red flags, the things which historically tend to lead to serious abuses of human rights or even genocide. So, I don't know, maybe 8 weeks ago, I think it was, coincidentally, and I'm sure it is only coincidence because it can't possibly have happened this fast, but the day I went public with the fact that I was going to send a report to the Lemkin Institute and call on them to issue a red flag alert, they promptly issued a red flag alert. So I think some clever person actually got there before me and put something in, but it looked really good. Because I had announced it. I was asked to give the keynote at London Pride at the Human Rights Forum. And I chose that moment to say, you know, sadly, it's my duty to blah, blah, blah. And then lo and behold, the next day they do it. But our own country is now the subject of a genocide early warning.
I mean, it sounds unbelievable.
Yeah, and
I mean,
politicians don't know it.
And to
they're not told.
To someone who despite once having been a bit of a radical firebrand, has just become a boring middle-aged, middle-of-the-road person, to use the word genocide regarding the UK and in relation to trans people feels over the top.
Yes, it does.
And in inflammatory. And yet, and again, I'm going to probably make myself sound really silly here, but you and I know, and indeed I suspect every trans person here knows, a non-binary person here knows, that when Germany took those steps towards that utterly bleak path that led to the very specific genocide of Jewish people and many others, the starting point
was trans people.
Was trans people.
Yeah. Yes.
And the destruction of the Institute.
Yeah. And trans people were in concentration camps. They were imprisoned in concentration camps. They died as well.
So whilst, I mean, I find it hard to believe that a Greenbelt audience in any way is not engaged with this stuff, because that's who we are as Greenbelt. Nonetheless, it's really important that that marker exists.
It's where it goes.
And that we take it out.
It'll be another group next, you see.
Yeah, without us sounding, wildly alarmist, there is a truth here.
I mean, it sets the tone, I think, for society. I mean, you can see these riots and the violence and so on outside asylum seekers' hotels. You can see the rash of flags and slogans and so on being painted. It's part of the rise of nationalism in a way, because it's about absolutism. It's about what is natural and good and proper in a human being so that the others are not that. So that we've now endorsed a biological purity sort of approach to what sex is. There's no in-between.
Intersex people have been completely
erased.
Intersex people
have been deleted. But there's no concept of what that is. But it's that unspoken thing of, well, one instinctively knows.
And it strikes me that one of the devices, bolsters to that whole way of thinking around natural categories, what is natural, what is normal, is actually certain readings of faith.
I think a lot of this has come from, I think at least half of it has come from the very conservative wing of the evangelical church in America.
Yeah.
Who are very open about the fact that you can start with trans people, because that is a way to get the debate going, because ultimately gay relationships are unnatural.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's part of that. And we've seen this with the de-lesbianing of some lesbians now, for example, in this country, and just making their lives harder too. So it leads nicely into that direction in order to restore, as they would see it, the proper biblical nature of relationships between men and women.
So how, Vicky, do you locate yourself in Roman Catholicism as a person of faith? I mean, I don't know if you want to say a little bit about your faith journey and Catholic, yeah, and is, yeah, you know, coming out as Roman Catholic, is that different? You know, is that different to coming out as trans? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, well, it was a bit easier actually. I had my own sort of conversion experience. I went to there's this thing, judges get invited, not every judge every year, but actually in the type of judge I was, you often get invited once a year to the opening of the legal year, which is, it's a church service. Needless to say, it's in Westminster Abbey, so it's an Anglican service. You get curly sandwiches and bad wine served by the Lord Chancellor, and the standard of the food goes down each year, the more they cut the funding. And you sit through a service, and it's very nice, and it's all like, you know, praying that you're going to make the right decisions and all that sort of thing. But there was a colleague I didn't necessarily get on with. I won't identify who they are. But I decided, basically out of spite, not to go to the Anglican service, because there's a parallel Catholic one. They run their own show separately at Westminster Cathedral.
Oh, I didn't know this.
Yes, it's,
I might
really
go as
good.
An Anglican.
It's,
I might,
much better, seriously. The sandwiches are less curly. Vatican bread, it's wonderful.
Well, it's, and the bread is authentically Jesus. Well.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yes, Christ goes to the Catholic service. So I went. Unlike the government-sponsored one, if you want to have the curly sandwiches, you pay. There's a charity, the Thomas More Society, that I'm a great supporter of. And they exist to have the Red Mass, as it's called. So I went to that instead, because you're allowed to do that. And they'll put on a taxi and they treat you equally, because they'd be sued if they didn't. Partway through the service, I felt very moved.
Yeah.
At the point where they were blessing the host. And, I mean, it's the usual Catholic thing. There was smells and bells, and that probably helped. But and then I started getting immediately very curious, and I went to Mass a few times, and then I asked to be catechized, I guess is the right word, and converted. And I was never religious in the slightest before that, except in the way that many trans people are, in that I think most trans people, when they were children, will have prayed to a god they probably didn't believe in to make them wake up as a girl or a boy.
I absolutely did. I mean, yeah. I actually gave up,
yeah,
on God as a teenager, because I thought either God didn't exist or God was just an evil bastard who made people like me and you for sport, essentially.
And look what he's given me. I mean, it worked. Here I am.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. It's like, thank you,
I'm
Jesus.
Really happy.
Thank you, God. Yeah. It's just, I mean, you know, God works in his, her, their own time.
And,
you know,
and if I may say so, he did a very good job with both of us.
Indeed.
But no, I actually do believe that the really amazingly happy life I've led since I came out in my 20s, I transitioned in my 20s, long time ago now, I've had the most happy existence I could ever have. I'm a deeply happy person. And then I got religion on top of it. You know, what's not to like? And I'm even more happy now, despite what's going on.
Yeah.
And in a way, it gives me strength to fight.
Yeah. What words of encouragement, wisdom, might you have for, let's start off for, you know, trans and non-binary siblings at this time? Because I don't mind saying that, well, all that you've said is true, and I agree with that. But in the, gosh, many decades since I transitioned in my early 20s, I have never felt as pushed to the side of my life as when I have in these past few months. And I try and reassure myself to say, whatever the Supreme Court says, you know, whatever the EHRC says, and whatever guidance is issued, ultimately no laws have been changed. I will continue to use the women's loos. I will continue to use women's changing rooms. I will continue to live my life. I'm determined to do so. And there is a, you know, that is just how it is. And in a sense, I want to say that there's so much noise, but, you know, what's the encouragement or is there, you know, or do we have to be honest?
I mean, I actually sadly do caution trans people against using the ladies' loos unless they are prepared to get arrested. As a judge, I'm no longer a judge now, but as a judge, I couldn't take the risk of getting caught. What would happen, and what does happen, is there's a very powerful, very well-funded lobby that would sue you. You'd be sued for sexual harassment, or the business would be sued and you'd be sued as a co-defendant for discrimination and harassment. And of course, I think that's happening to that doctor in Scotland at the moment who was given permission to use a changing room and used it and is a co-defendant in the case. And of course, then what happens, given the amount of media capture, is you're then all over the newspapers, before and after photographs, details about your family, you'll get the hate mail. So if one's going to use those spaces, I think you've got to be in a job that you're not going to lose if you're caught. And of course, there's a well-known author who has called for us to be photographed in the loos and then for our photos to be published.
Looking
to catch us. I mean,
I get that, yeah. But that itself, yeah. Doesn't that infringe our Article 8 rights to privacy through?
No, because even leading novelists are not public bodies.
But having our photos taken in the,
you might be able to treat it as a form of harassment, maybe. But then they would say, well, it's actually defending women against rapists. And they would raise a
just honestly. I'm having argument. Such a physical. It feels almost awful to do this in front of hundreds of people. But just to say, the sheer horror of that, as someone who has been sexually harassed and indecently assaulted by men, just wrong.
Yes, it is. And sadly, I think these people believe it, which is why you can't persuade some people, you can't persuade out of it because it is their belief. I think experience and getting to know does change people, but by no means all. And for a lot of people, it's a genuine fear, probably of the unknown, to be truthful. But in reality, they're effectively going to encourage rape because they're expecting me, and I'm essentially anatomically female, to have to use the men's loos or the men's changing rooms. I've left the country. I've emigrated to Ireland, where I count as a woman, so that's fine. And I'm running a network called the Trans Exile Network, which is helping people get out of the country in the hundreds, because obviously people can't continue living in that unsafe space. Even now in hospitals, we've had reports of, for example, a trans man who was in for a gynecological procedure, turns up, you know, beard and tattoos and all the rest of it, but turns up for a gynecological procedure, goes to the men's ward because he was directed to the men's ward, And oddly enough, his name wasn't on the list because it was in the gynecological ward. So then he was sent to the gynecological ward, which caused panic. And he was sent right down to the end of the ward, screened off with curtains, and told not to leave the curtains. And was just hidden away at the end of the ward. This is a women's ward with a trans man on it. I know of another person who went into hospital for a procedure of some sort. Trans woman was placed post-op, 10-year post-op trans woman, so therefore essentially female anatomy, placed on an all-male ward simply behind screens. So brought in, if you like the proverbial leper. And indeed, the last pope, I think, did refer to trans people as being treated like lepers. Mm. And that person self-discharged untreated from hospital because they couldn't stand it.
Yeah.
So all of those things are really coming to the fore.
To counter this, I mean, there are perhaps folks like me who say, I need to carry on and live my life as I must. And I think that that's important. Yeah. But it sounds like the hope is found in the long game. I mean, I'm reminded that back in the back when we had the Gender Recognition Act in 2004, no government gave that to us. They were forced through the European Court of Human Rights.
Yeah, the Goodwin case.
And so ultimately,
the UK is in breach of existing law. I mean, the UK is infringing our Article 8 rights in exactly the way, in fact, worse than it was at the time of Goodwin, which is the act, which is the case that led to the Gender Recognition Act in the first place. So the UK is literally just bailed out of complying with a European Court of Human Rights judgment. As we're going to find out eventually, the problem is cases in Strasbourg, it could take 10 years.
Yeah.
I'm 55 years old. I'm not coming back. I'm gone for good. But I'm going to try and change things in this country from a distance if I can.
And we're human beings. Yeah. We carry on. We adapt. You know, one of my deepest anxieties right now is that this is happening. It has happened. Something desperate has taken place. Something is rotten in the UK, not in Denmark, you know, in the UK.
Yeah.
And yet we adapt. We carry on. And it becomes normalised until the next shift. Mm. We have wonderful people here, allies, you know, us trans and non-binary people, we ain't going to be able to do this alone. We need allies. Yeah, we need to do this together. How can cis, non-trans allies actually aid? You know, what are some practical things that
well, I mean, there. I mean, there's an instant example is there's a petition called Not In Our Name, which is being signed by cis women. I think it's got about 50,000 signatures on it already. You can find that online. N-I-O-N, not in our name. Really, just to show that this gender-critical ideological movement is actually a very niche interest. It just has a very powerful, loud and well-funded voice, backed by, in part, by money from overseas and, of course, by the ultra-conservative right in America, who are running the same agenda, of course, in America, because it's really only the UK and America that have this problem. The rest of the world looks on in horror, I think. What on earth's going on? I don't think Europe's going to be happy. But I think people should write to their MPs. That can change minds, because I know from rumours that I've heard that members of parliament and even ministers were surprised at the level of disagreement with this decision and the level of voices that were standing up and speaking. I thought they thought people just... They're going to welcome it. I think they thought it was a populist thing to do, and it turns out not to be, actually.
And at the risk of sounding facetious, but this is actually a deeply serious point, there is a certain famous author who wrote a series of books that I'll call Mallory Towers with Magic.
Tolkien Light, I think.
Yeah. just... Can we just stop giving her money? Because... She's just using it to create funds to destroy trans lives. And it's really challenging. I know, I mean, you know, these books are pushed on children, aren't they? As, you know, yes, great and stuff. I kind of loved them once upon a time. Very popular
in the trans community, ironically.
Yeah, exactly, because at the time, they represent a space where someone could be different from, from who they were told to be. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, hey, I mean, I wasn't planning on saying this, but I believe there's a new HBO series coming out, rerunning it. Let's not watch it. Let's not watch it. Yeah.
Yes, I do get wound up when I see a lot of shops in London selling, you know, bric-a-brac and memorabilia of that ilk. I walk past. I think you're actually literally fundraising against me.
It is quite an extraordinary thing, isn't it, to
literally fundraising against me. And indeed, the case in the Supreme Court was partly funded by a certain children's author. So briefly, I was on the opposite side of the case. Briefly, because as you probably know, I applied to be a party to the Supreme Court case, but I was... In fact, any trans people were refused. I was one of two people who did actually ask to be joined as a party.
Why did they do that?
And I mean, they just refused it and they didn't give any reasons. So all we have is an order saying no. And it meant that at no stage in the entire case were any trans voices heard or the argument for us and our human rights put. And as a result, even competent judges are going to get it wrong, because in this country we have an adversarial system of justice. In other words, the lawyers turn up and they present their cases and the judges decide the cases. The judges don't make up the case. They don't leap in and invent legal arguments that they give to one side or another. They don't investigate in the way that you might say in France in a different system. So if you only hear one set of arguments presented in one way, substantially, if you're a good judge, you're going to decide a certain way, aren't you? Because it's part of the discipline of judging. You don't invent things that weren't put to you. And therefore, with the best will in the world, we were going to end up with this judgment. No lawyers expected it. And as I say, I'm absolutely sure it's legally wrong. But it also infringes our Article 8 rights. But the only way to deal with that is in Strasbourg now, and possibly get a rehearing on the basis that it was an unfair process. And then there's the long way round, which is start cases in this country, and then they have to take years to go up through the system and eventually end up at Strasbourg. But again, that'll take a decade. So the only solution in any reasonable time is actually a political one. The only solution I see is to get Labour actually to change its mind. I don't think the other parties have got the slightest chance of changing their minds, but I think Labour politicians, probably in their heart of hearts, are pretty horrified by this, but they're too scared. They're too scared to speak because the lobby against us are vicious. They will write hate mail. My workplace, I mean, I'm a legal consultant. I don't actually earn any money, but I'm a legal consultant on paper at least. They're getting hate mail. Their staff are having to read the hate mail. This is not a nice, friendly, concerned group of citizens. These are movements which can get very, very nasty indeed. And I don't think Labour ought to be associating itself with that movement. But I can see that politicians are scared. They don't want that abuse. They don't want to be accused of facilitating child abusers or supporting what is characterised as an ideology that infiltrates its way into schools and institutions, which is being trans. That's how we've been cast. We are almost like an infection that spreads our ideology. I mean, I see it the other way around. I see the gender critical ideological movement as doing something similar. But
I mean, I spend a lot of time trying not to get into that trench and wanting to sort of make my enemy so clearly other that there's not possible to talk. But it's very, very challenging.
I think how one uses language is important, because language has been used against us. And as a community, we've been actually very tolerant. We haven't really given as good as we're getting, actually, for the most part. And journalists I've spoken to, when they've interviewed me, and they've also interviewed, you know, someone on the other side, so to speak, privately they've told me that they always find it's the trans people who are suggesting people they should be interviewing for balance. They actually positively want the story to be told properly. We've been too generous. And I think it's time to use some of that language back at them. They are an ideology. In fact, they pride themselves really on being an ideology, yep, because they say it's our protected belief legally. They're largely wrong about that too, because the thing that's the protected belief is literally narrowly the belief that there are two sexes and you can't change them. It's a belief, that's it. The rest of it is not a protected belief. But, of course, it's never been clearly articulated. And therefore, a belief that I shouldn't be in the loos is said to be a protected belief.
And I think there is a time for a sort of steel, for a toughness. I think what's fascinating for me as someone who, in exercising my leadership role in the Church of England, and sometimes finding myself in spaces which are less sympathetic to trans people. And, you know, when I've exercised my toughness, my voice, when I've stood up, there have been occasions when I've been accused of operating out of male privilege. And actually, we cannot win, you see.
No, of course not. Because, you know, either we shut up and be meek.
But actually say something. Yeah. And it's, you know, if you're putting up and shutting up and being meek, oh, you're buying into a feminine stereotype.
You can't win.
So we can't win except by being ourselves.
I tend to... Sometimes I use forceful language. A lot of the time I use slightly humorous language. I actually tend to treat this sort of thing as sort of trivial and a bit weird. And I sort of take that approach as it's all a bit distasteful.
Absolutely. I mean, I think us trans people have got a terrific sense of humour. And I have to say, in my own particular case, I mean, when you've got a surname like Mann, you have to have a cosmic sense. Of humour, essentially, being a trans woman. Now, I think at this point, it would be good to open it up for some questions. So we've got a couple of mics. We've got some hands up. I spotted the hand of the person... Oh, am I not in charge of this bit? Sorry, I'm shut up.
No, that's... that's fine. But yeah, we've got people in maroon vests coming round with mics. And can I just remind you all to do questions rather than statements so that we can fit as many as possible?
Yes, it's not an academic conference. Where,
exactly. Great. So we will start with a question over here.
Okay.
Hi there. Thank you. I wrote to my MP. We've spoken to my MP. And his response is... Well, I can't do anything about it. What do I need to say to him to get him to actually get involved?
That's really unfortunate because...
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, the problem can be fixed tomorrow because when I've been around long enough to remember that when the 2004 Act was drafted and I looked at the bill before it was published, and there's a section of the Act, Section 23, which was included to deal with situations such as this because... Having an Act of Parliament that changes people's sex was quite radical, really. And it was expected that there would be the occasional bit they've missed somewhere in legislation or some regulation somewhere that needs to be fixed that you've overlooked. And Section 23 enables Bridget Phillipson to make an order. Doesn't have to have a statutory instrument, doesn't have to have a debate in Parliament, doesn't have to be a law. She has the power to make an order to amend any statute to correct issues. So tomorrow... She has to consult, so it'd be a very short consultation if it was tomorrow. But apart from consulting, that's all she has to do. She could amend the Gender Recognition Act or the Equality Act to resolve what is essentially poor drafting in the Equality Act. The Supreme Court put it in all sorts of flourishing ways that were borrowed from the skeleton arguments of the parties, and large chunks of it essentially quoted. I saw a great takedown of it, actually, by a legal academic who did side-by-side comparisons of passages in the judgments and in the skeleton arguments, and you can see that they've essentially cut and pasted. But that power could be used to put it right tomorrow, and the Supreme Court, in effect, has found that there's a problem in the drafting of the Equality Act. They could have put it in those terms. They could have said, probably the intention of Parliament was to change sex for all purposes, but the way this Act... is written has accidentally had the contrary effect, and then Parliament would have to hopefully fix it. They didn't. They took a gender-critical line and adopted the skeleton arguments. But the upshot is just that it's a drafting problem in the Equality Act, and that can be fixed tomorrow by Bridget Phillipson. So the answer is tell the MP to ask about making a Section 23 order. And I'm going to be writing to Bridget Phillipson on behalf of the Trans Axel Network and hopefully other groups. And I will be publishing that letter, and I will be proposing a possible suitable amendment, and I will be asking her to make a decision, yes or no, to correct it, because then Labour is going to have to come out either for or against us. It's that binary. And that could then lead to legal action if it was refused. So there are avenues such as that, but something you can mention to an MP is in fact that.
Great, and we got one over here. Where's my colleague?
I was going to ask if... So obviously you said about, you know, writing to MPs, and I'm very much someone who goes to protest. Is there anything that you can suggest that we can be doing directly? I'm non-binary myself, but can... I hate using the term. I can pass very well as a cis woman when I need to. Is there anything that, like, people in my position can be doing besides, obviously, if someone's taking a photo of someone in a bathroom being like, what are you doing? Yeah. That's weird.
I do things like, if I'm invited to an event, let's say I'm invited to a dinner, you know, I'm speaking at a conference or whatever, and they invite me to a speaker's dinner, I contact the venue in advance and ask them exactly what their bathroom policy is. And I use that as a form of advocacy, because you can make it clear in letters like that that they are choosing to segregate. You do not have to have men and women loos. You do not have to segregate. There is no legal requirement for it, but most businesses have been misled into thinking it is. And you can achieve quite good advocacy. So if you're going to be considering using a venue for something, don't use them if they have chosen sex segregation. If they say, use the disabled loo, which I'm not prepared to do. If they say, go next door. I had a restaurant say that I'd have to go to the restaurant next door if I wanted to go to the loo. So I obviously cancelled my booking. And many of them are choosing what in fact is the more difficult path by segregating, because they're going to have to enforce it probably. The guidance will be out soon, and I bet you there'll be rules about enforcing it by checking documents. When they didn't have that trouble, if they didn't sex segregate. And, you know, the Supreme Court decision includes a subjective test. So, in other words, if I was using the men's loos, as I'm told I'm supposed to, if I was deemed to be too female-looking, I can be excluded from those too. But I still can't use the ladies, okay? And that's true with trans men. And, anyone who knows a trans man, although they're quite, you know, often quite hunky, don't I say.
Hey, looking at you.
I say that as a newly straightened lesbian myself. But you can imagine, I mean, come on. I mean, a bunch of trans lads have been up playing rugby going to the ladies because they're obliged to. Of course they're going to get excluded. The police will be called. So we've got this bizarre subjective test on top of a so-called biological test. So we cannot win. It's absurd. But the point is that you can do activism actually by laying that out so that businesses actually know that their business is being affected. If they don't,
yeah.
If they've chosen to adopt gender-critical ideology, don't use them.
Amazing. And we've got one over here. Oh, here, sorry.
I'm a huge fan. I've heard you speak really elegantly about this before, but what can we do to really prove that biological sex is a nonsense? How can we show it's absurd?
I think the starting point would be to ask them to say what they mean by it. Because then otherwise you're chasing a moving target. I think it's for them to say what they mean.
I think
you can pick holes in it.
Because I think that's absolutely spot on. I mean, so often the position that is adopted is that we are the ones who have to justify ourselves. Whereas it's, I don't know if you ever saw that famous clip that went round the internet, whereby there was a right-wing commentator who was going on about woke this, woke that, to which the person on the TV channel just said, well, what do you mean by woke?
Yes.
And they completely got themselves caught up in knots. Mm. As soon as someone starts talking about biological sex or dimorphic sex, actually, what do you mean? And it very rapidly devolves into a sub-GCSE level understanding of biology.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, what sex am I, you know, if I'm more female than male, well, you know, where am I? Endocrinologically, I'm female.
And, you know, and again, if you, yeah, if you really do want to have a go at the answer, you want to say, well, do you mean chromosomally?
Yeah,
you
off
mean,
you go. Yeah.
Do you mean morphologically? Mm. Is it in terms of endocrological? I really can't say words,
endocrinological.
Can I? You know the words.
Yes.
And so,
yes.
Because in terms of what we mean by biological sex, I think generally it's meant to resolve to XX and XY. I mean, one of the questions I have actually said to someone when they've said this is to say, so do you know that you are XX? And when we start talking about biological sex, are we really saying that we need to be carrying around little cards,
well, I mean,
which define our genotype?
Well, of course, the recent Act of Parliament that's passed, the Data Use and Privacy Act, I think it's something like that. I mean, that paves the way, of course, for compulsory ID cards. And my vision, if you like, as to, I won't say I have a dream, it's rather the opposite, but my vision as to what they're probably going to do is that as part of the process of rolling that out, one of the key requirements in the Act is data must be accurate. And accuracy at the moment would mean that that card would have to record me as biologically male because I was registered as male at birth, which is actually, I think, what they mean by biology, bizarrely. So that card would contain that information. It would also contain my gender history and say that I'm female for certain purposes. The point is that will then enable restaurants to have QR code access, that sort of thing. And it'd be very easy. For example, the police at the moment have a policy if they're strip searching trans people that if you're a trans woman, they must use a male officer to strip search you because you're a man. The problem is, of course,
The horror of it. I'm
yeah,
sorry.
I mean, regardless of anatomy. And it'll only be a matter of time before an officer is accused of sexual assault, of course. And it can be used as an excuse for people posing as police, of course, or used for you know, illegitimate purposes, if I can put it that way. The point is that then obviates the problem of strip searching lesbians because they're thought to be trans because you could just check the card.
Am I sounding horribly like a character out of an Agatha Christie novel? But this is just not British. It's sort of entirely against the spirit of what it means to live in this nation.
Yes. No, absolutely. In one of her books, it used to have a very un-PC name. It's now called 10 Little Indians, I think, which is not actually very PC, even so. But in that, the judge did it, which is great. But anyway, no, it's not British. I think sooner or later, a lot of people are realising it. The problem is people feel powerless because the government ain't listening. But yeah, what you say, you've got this strip search issue, for example, and having ID cards, I think, will enable easy enforcement because businesses which are given a legal obligation to enforce it will have a legitimate reason to check your card. In reality, that will come down to an appearance test because I don't suppose they're really going to spend money having people on the doors. If you are a woman who happens to not look stereotypically female, perhaps you're non-Western, so you're not conforming to British stereotypes, you'll be carded, basically. Do you look like you're under 21? You know, you'll be carded. It's like going to be an age test. But for the typical trans person who passes for female, they're not going to be asked. It'll be the lesbians that get it. It'll be trans people who don't pass. And it'll be...
Or don't want to pass.
Or don't want to pass, yeah. And it will be non-binary people as well, if they're choosing to have a non-gendered appearance. And it will be used also by racists, because if you are in a shopping mall and you're a racist, you can't go to the shopping mall police and say there's a black person in the loo, because the shopping mall police will go, yeah, they'll know that's illegal to go and do anything. You can say there's a man in the loos. There's a black man in the ladies' loos. And you can get that person hassled. They may be politely hassled and the security guard might look and go, hang on, this is rubbish. But you're still hassling them. It's a great way to make people feel uncomfortable and to harass them legitimately, because no one can prove that you didn't think they were a man. So effectively, it's like calling the police on them just to harass them. That can be used for bad purposes. and I've no doubt that it will be. So all of these things can be very, very easily abused. And in some ways, carding at least might make the process less painful for those who are not trans, because you'll be able to prove what your birth sex was. And that may help a lot of lesbians, because at least they will be checked quickly rather than manhandled out of the loos and police being called, as often happens.
I think we've probably got time for one more question. Yeah. Have you got someone over here? Yeah.
You mentioned the Not In Our Name website for cis women to sign up to. What can we cis men do to join together and show our support?
That's a really great question, because I don't think there isn't a sort of an equivalent petition. And of course, if there was and it was for men, it would probably be back. It would be used against us by saying, see, the men support these men. I think it is about consumer power, actually. It is about being clear with businesses that you won't use them if they are sex segregating, if they have chosen to sex segregate. In other words, if the little girl picture on the door doesn't mean women and women who have the protected characteristic of gender reassignment, which they can perfectly legitimately do. They can put a little notice on the door if they want, or just put it up on the door as you go in, that the loos are not sex specific, or that trans women and women legally are welcome. If they don't do that, again, it's about consumer power. I wouldn't do it, but I would let them know that you're not doing it. I mean, I would like to really have a campaign of cis, and it's only me, there's not many of us. I'd actually like to have a campaign, and one thing I'm planning is to create something called the Pink Book, which will be, it's inspired by the Green Book of segregation era United States, which will set out the policies of businesses and shops so that trans people can safely navigate the hostile space that we now live in, and so that consumers can take their business elsewhere for those who are segregating. It'll be a manual for who not to use just as much as a manual for who to use. And if the gender critical people are proud of their belief, well, they can pay and advertise and be proud of their belief and put that in the book, because I'm betting that British people will vote with their feet.
I think that's an amazing note to end on. And I think most of us could listen to these two incredible women speak for hours. Unfortunately, we can't. And we've got the rest of Greenbelt to explore. But thank you so much to both Rachel and Victoria. We're so grateful for everything you're doing, and we're so grateful that you're here at Greenbelt with us.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.